So now it's my real pleasure to introduce Bill Riley, who was the administrator of the EPA during the George H.W. Bush administration. And he has also served as the president of the World Wildlife Fund, which is actually where I met Bill at a couple of board-related events focusing on climate change. WWF had a very active climate change program, and I was privileged to serve there for a couple of years while on a sabbatical. Bill has also had a lot of experience in the business field, starting up a number of business ventures, and he's also served on a lot of other boards of directors as well. And notably, in 2010, he was appointed by President Obama to chair the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and has done really a great job in producing a fine report on that crisis. So he has his Harvard Law degree and an AB in history from Yale. So, Bill, thank you very much for agreeing to say some things.
Thank you, Richard. Ralph, ladies and gentlemen. It is, I think, a very signal moment to create this board with the mission that I understand it has. And I salute those of you who conceived this idea and how now are bringing it forward. I have a very personal history of appreciation of the contribution that the National Research Council, the National Academy, can make to public policy. I was the only non-scientist on the Commission on Natural Resources back in the early 80s, I think it was, which meant that there were conversations that just went right over my head. But there was a sense of method. There was a seriousness of purpose and a real desire to make the intersections between scientific judgments and information and their relevance to policy. And I remember I was asked by someone, some senator, when I was at my confirmation hearing for EPA, what succinctly will you take as your function, your special contribution as EPA administrator? And I said, well, if I had to put it as simply as I could, I would say to take the two lines of public attitude and perceptions of risk together with the best scientific information we have about the seriousness and priority that should be assigned to those risks, and to try to bring those curves to coincide, those lines to coincide. I said I have no illusions that we can get them completely to coincide, because obviously the public cares about a lot of things that scientists don't. And I quickly discovered one. In fact, before I was appointed as EPA administrator, I told the Science Advisory Board at EPA that what I wanted them to do was to analyze the threats to the public health, the environment, and the ecology of the people of the United States and rank them. And then tell me to what degree the agency in its allocation of budget priorities conformed to the scientific perception and significance of those problems. Well, what they told me, very straight out, they told me, you are spending your money, two-thirds of it, on second-order concerns, basically hazardous waste. And I can't count the number of times because of previously agreed court settlements, I had to sign something that involved a cost of $300, $500, $700 million to the private sector. And I would ask the question, well, what's the premature death mortality associated with this chemical, whatever it was we were regulating? And somebody would have to say sheepishly, well, actually, we don't think there is any, but, you know, it's the law, and it was the settlement, and that's what it was agreed to. And we worked hard to try to get a better sense of the law and the policy and get it to conform to scientific viewpoints. On the climate issue, when I served in office, all we had were computer models. They were pretty persuasive. The vast preponderance of scientific information, scientific opinion in my time, as I quoted many times, really was that we had a very significant problem of building in the climate field, and we needed to address it. And periodically, the public shared that concern. Not all the time, but from time to time. But people don't march for computer models. It's a real question whether they march for science, too. But it's the job, I think, of people who lead in public policy to translate science and to help them learn why they should march for it. I personally think that we have screwed up the messaging somewhat on climate in the United States. And I've recently come to the conclusion that we've done it. There are three things that we ought to do differently. And I say this as somebody who's guilty of it myself. First of all, I think that the drumbeat of dire futures that lie in wait for us is a little bit numbing. I think that if the evidence of your own eyes does not support how terrible things are going to get, or if when you're told the world is warming and we have the snowstorms that we had last year, the year before here, it's a hard message to get through. It also is a boring message. I think it's a very negative and distressing, discouraging message. And there will come a time, I think, and probably as a consequence of very unusual and severe weather, when that message will be more better received. But I don't think we're there yet. So I think we've made a mistake in possibly overdoing it. Secondly, I think we've insufficiently attended to the significance of adaptation and the fact that it really is going on. I was awarded the Scully Prize this past fall, and in preparing for that lecture, learned about what some cities are doing. Straightforward, prudential, public policy planners, most notably of which I think is Mayor Daley, not a notorious tree hugger, former mayor of Chicago. But what they have done, which is design a whole new pavement, which is 80% water permeable, and that doesn't buckle in severe cold and hot spells, ban the three trees. I grew up in Illinois. The state tree is banned now in Chicago's parks. They plant 2,200 trees a year. The white ash is no more. The Norway spruce and the maple also. They won't make it in the new plant zone. So they're planting Alabama sweet gum in Chicago. They're expecting for the level of the lake to drop over time. Under one of the worst prognoses, like 18 inches, it's a lot. They're expecting a threefold increase in hospital admissions due to heat stroke, up from 400 in the range of 1,200. And they're talking about air conditioning their schools, even though they're on their backs financially as a city. All of these things were presented as reasonable accommodations to a relatively agreed upon by their universities and their authorities in the universities predictable future. I used to think of adaptation was the back door to awareness of the need for mitigation. I think increasingly it's the front door. I think a lot of people who otherwise are distracted and not paying that much attention to it are going to say, there's got to be something really to this if so many adaptations are being made. And there's something like 1,000 cities in America who are doing many things, less, I think, than Chicago. But I would pay attention to that. I really would. And the third area where I think we need to attend to changing some of our messaging is, I think the degree to which those of us who have tried to be prophetic about climate change have engaged in moralistic rectitude have overdone it. I think part of the message that's come through to the people who are not quite there is that, well, maybe they're immoral if they don't see the moral significance, the moral dimensions of the problem. And I'm not saying there isn't a moral dimension to Earth stewardship. I'm just saying that I don't think that has been the best thing to message. Those are some thoughts that I have relative to your function. I think it's fabulous that you're going to look seriously at some of these very same questions at risk and how they're being managed and how they might be better communicated. I've always thought that at EPA, I had a lot of conversations with Bill Ruckelshaus, who talks about how little science there was in the first iterations of our statutes, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. We just did it and looked for support sometimes, and it wasn't always there. But basically, over the long course of time, it has been there. And I was a client of the National Research Council many times, several hundred thousand dollars when I was in office. Used to have some complaints about they're not allowing dissents and pushing too hard for consensus, which I think has been fixed. And I remember ruining the lunch one day with somebody who was going to head a panel that was supposed to tell us whether they really needed full secondary treatment in San Diego, given the characteristics of the seas and upwelling and all of that. And I said, I just have two messages. First of all, cut it clean, yes or no. don't tell me on the one hand, on the other hand. Oh, he said, well, we're going to give the whole spectrum of... And I said, no, that's exactly what I don't want. Secondly, he called for another drink then, I think. I said, secondly, get this done on my watch. It'll take my successor 2 years to figure it out and get back to it and everything. I've been deeply immersed in it. I have promised to follow the science. The science is the secular religion. It is really what you have to base environmental policy, public health policy on. And as I say, you will often not do it purely because of the public attitudes on various things, but eventually those lines will... They won't completely converge, but they're going to come closer, and I really believe that this group is going to help them converge. So good luck to you. Thank you.